Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 5 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. in Newfoundland and Labrador, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Before I go any further, I should say I will be making a very rare Friday appearance with Tucker Carlson tonight, live across America. If you're listening to this live, it'll be in 4 hours' time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. If you listen to this when we post the action replay, it's probably closer to 2 hours. Or you might have missed it entirely. But I'll be joining Tucker at the top of the show, 8 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. That's 5 p.m. Pacific Time. Things are moving rather fast here. President Trump won a modest legal victory in Pennsylvania late yesterday, but in Arizona today, he has abandoned his legal case in the state of Arizona. And he has just told his chum Geraldo, also of Fox News, that he will do the right thing. He and Geraldo go way back. So there seems to be some movement afoot on the Trump side of things. We are here to talk about the United States election and various other matters that that are on your mind. And this is how it works. You don't have to be a Mark Stein Club member to listen to the show, but you have to be a Mark Stein Club member to ask a question. We always love to hear from you, especially on the first of our Clubland Q&As live around the planet after the turbulent events of the last couple of weeks. Al Mann from CA, which I think is California rather than the Dominion of Canada, says, "Hi, Mark. Many thanks to you, Tucker and Rush, for fighting the good fight for all of us. It must be exhausting. I suspect that many Mark Stein Club member households are like mine. My better half has had it with politics and doesn't want to hear my rantings or explanations. She feels she can manage her sanity better, especially during the Chinese flu debacle. However, this morning while serving her coffee, she had the Today Show on the telly and they were claiming that this is the most secure election in history. I almost lost it. And then they claimed that Homeland Security says the same. If Homeland Security actually said that, here is my question. Do you think that the swamp creatures in government will now feel emboldened to openly attack the president? Best regards. Thank you again." Al, your missus has the right idea. It makes a lot of sense. She says she's done with politics, and that's fine. But if you're done with politics, Mrs. Al, don't waste your life watching the Today Show on NBC. It's been total crap since the late 1950s. You shouldn't be watching that show. Don't waste your life on it. It's one thing to say, I'm not going to pay any attention to politics. It's another thing to watch the Today Show. Hey, was that the one Matt Lauer was on? You really want to watch a show from some guy who has a button on his desk that locks the door so you can't get out of there? Just because you've been watching the Today Show since the guy with the chimp in 1952 is no reason to carry on watching it. You're not actually locked in there like Matt Lauer's victims. You're free to just switch it off. Switch it off. If you're gonna abandon politics, don't abandon it for the soft focus politics of these morning shows, because a lot of them are wrecked. What's the one that used to be quite good that was completely apolitical? And it had dear old Petula Clark on a couple of years back, recalling that the first song she ever sang on the BBC was Mighty Like a Rose. Well, the Sunday morning one, CBS Sunday Morning. They've wrecked that. Don't watch, don't give up politics, real politics, and then go for the soft focus pseudo politics of those shows. Now, as to what the Department of Homeland Security and all this, the most secure election in history, America's elections, just to be clear on this, it's looking from what he said to Geraldo as if the president doesn't think he can win. I think he, in the courts, I think he won the election on Tuesday night and it was then stolen from him because you have the crappiest elections in the Western world. I mean, it's a joke. You've got every county has its own election system. It's a national office. There's only two of them, the president and the vice president, and it should actually be fought on a uniform ballot. If, for example, this were an election in a foreign country, like the recent Ukrainian election and one or two, not the Ukrainian one, what was the one I'm thinking of? The US State Department would not certify this election if it took place in a foreign country because it breaks all their rules. And so for years we've had all this thing, these thousands of, every county having different electoral systems, Dominion voting systems from Toronto actually controls the elections in 33 states and has an algorithm, a problematic algorithm that every time you pop out for a cup of coffee transfers 6,000 votes from Trump to Biden. I mean, you know, you don't need an algorithm for an election. You need paper ballots with X's in boxes and then little old ladies count them. And that's the most secure election in the world, unless we're going to be like the Helmand province in Afghanistan and go to purple fingers. The election is garbage. I'm sick of it. And it's nothing to do. I'm sick of listening to constitutional fetishists hanging upside down in their constitutional dungeon going on about the Constitution, because there isn't anything in the Constitution about having two-year election campaigns culminating in thousands and thousands of incompatible mechanical systems monitoring the votes over a two-month period. And if you'd said that to the Founding Fathers, they'd say, come back, George III, all is forgiven. We're not, it's nothing to do with the Constitution. It's an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment. We waste so much time. And in this case, while we were talking about Beto O'Rourke, China became the dominant global power. You know, the most secure election in history. What they mean by that is that this time, last time round, we're expected to believe that $100,000 worth of Facebook ads placed here and there by Macedonian content farmers transferred the election to Donald Trump. Now they're saying, oh, we kept out Putin and we kept out the Macedonian content farmers, so at least this election could be stolen by the all-American election thieves of the Democrat Party. For some of us, that isn't any kind of improvement. We have a question from Russell Mack in Melbourne. I think Melbourne's just emerging from lockdown and people are going to be able to get to drive 20 miles across town or even take a spin, go motoring in the country for an afternoon. Russell Mack writes, hi, Mark. I recently rejoined the club after freeloading for about a year. Don't take this the wrong way, but I did it because I felt guilty. You seemed exhausted at being one of the few people fighting back against some of the madness occurring in 2020. One way was to say thanks was to put a few pennies in your pocket. Nobody has to join if they don't want to, Russell. We seek no unwilling members. And certainly there's a whole ton of stuff on the website that is completely free, whether you're in the club or not. And there's plenty of people listen to this who have no desire to join the club, and that's fine and dandy. But it's jolly nice to have you back, Russell. We value our Australian members, particularly in Victoria under these difficult times. What do you think, says Russell, of the way Trump and his campaign have handled the post-election fiasco? I'm appalled at their amateurishness. It's been such a scattergun approach. A bit of focus would be nice. I think they should publicise only the frauds and anomalies significant enough to swing a state back in their favour. Only Kayleigh should be the spokesperson. It'd be great if President Trump would stop tweeting about big things about to be revealed, because that's not going to happen, is it? And use a few props, e.g. a pie chart showing how many ballots were cast only in the presidential election without voting down the ballot. The difference between these ballots for Biden compared to Trump is beyond anything statistically possible. Even the mildly interested would see this points to something very suspicious. Look beyond the base for additional support. Less than 50 days till 2021, mate. We're going to get out of this annus horribilis soon, says Russell in Melbourne, Victoria. Yeah, it's not good. You know, it's I'm always in two situations at this stage. I'm always of two minds in the run up in the period before an election, because in the United States, to a degree that's not true, I think, in other countries, there's a great pressure to be a cheerleader, and I don't do cheerleading well, even for myself. I just told Russell there was no need for him to join the club, so I'm not even an effective cheerleader for the Mark Stein Club. But here's where it is at election time, and again, this is different from in my experience in Canada and the UK and other places. There's great pressure to be a cheerleader, which I find rather boring. It's not something I do at all well, and not to say anything bad about the campaign, no matter how self-evidently crap it is. You know, I've no use for people like Brad Parscale. I would still be interested to know, just because in any other field of endeavor other than a US election, $1 billion would be a lot of money. So I'm actually quite interested to know what Brad Parscale, or whatever his name is, did with that $1 billion, other than buy himself a $2.4 million waterfront mansion and a new Ferrari. And actually, there's no point having a Ferrari in America, because it's just double yellow lines in the middle of the road from Florida to Washington State. So you can't even do anything with a Ferrari that would be fun to do in a Ferrari, like cornering on the Grand Corniche in the south of France. You can't do that in a Ferrari here. So there's no point having a Ferrari in America, Brad. Give it back and give the money back to the Trump campaign. The problem, though, is if you say, oh, I wasn't sure, I didn't think Rudy Giuliani was particularly good in that press conference, you get people, oh yeah, you're just one of those never Trump. But you get into all that. There's going to be bloodletting about why President Trump wound up a one-term president. If the meaning of his apparent conversation with Geraldo proves true, there's going to be bloodletting. And the only question is, when is the day to start the bloodletting? Is the day when the states are certified? Is it when the Electoral College meets? Is it when Joe Biden, God help us? You know, that's the thing. It's not just, as I said on Rush a couple of days ago, America turned the dead voting into a national joke. It's been a joke for over a century here that the dead get to vote in American elections. The only thing this time is that they've elected one of their own as the president. So it's not just dead voters now, but a dead candidate. And that's the difference. That's the big difference. So the only question is, when is the appropriate time for the bloodletting to begin? I agree with you that Kayleigh McEnany is excellent, which is why I was furious when Neil Cavuto cut away from her the other day. She's excellent and she's focused. And the point about this is, there's a great legal principle. There are very few legal principles in America anymore, because it's all bollocks. But one of the great, if you respect the parts of the common law that get to the core principles, one of the most basic things is false in one thing, false in all. And that is, a witness has no credibility if he's shown to have lied about one little matter. It doesn't mean you should still accord him the discretion of taking everything he says as gospel just because one little thing's been proven false. No, the law says false in one thing, false in everything. In other words, he's destroyed his credibility. And that's what's going on in these elections. It's not a question of whether there were enough dead people voting in Jackson County, Michigan, to change the result of the election. It's that once you know There have been dead people voting in Jackson County, Michigan. It destroys the integrity of the election. The idea that the law should weigh in when there's 500 dead people voting, but not when there's 50 dead people voting, is preposterous. This country has insecure elections. It has the world's longest election campaign for the world's crappiest election procedures. And I say this as someone who agrees with Tocqueville that the New England form of town government is the greatest form of government devised by man, because I've sat in New Hampshire town meetings and seen the integrity of those elections for overseer of the poor or sexton or any of the other, you know, dozens and dozens of elected offices that that my little town has and every town in New Hampshire has. And I see the super integrity that goes into electing a sexton in a town with a few hundred people. And then I look at these corrupt states with their vile mechanical contraptions that are all rubbish. And I wonder what Tocqueville would make of that. You don't need to wonder what Tocqueville would make of that. You know very well. Richard Mallaby says, "Hi, Mark. Love the club. In hindsight, it all seems so easy, doesn't it? Flood states that have obsolete voter rolls with mail-in ballots, allow one set of partisan actors to count the votes while the other side is barred from verifying the tally, and accept votes not only after quote-unquote election day, but votes that no one can be certain were completed prior to the deadline. 100%. Manufactured chaos. Does anyone doubt that if it looked like Biden was on his way to winning, all the election officials went home for the night? And the next day, rural votes started trickling in to put Trump over the top, that the media might take pause celebrating the re-election of President Trump. I think what is going on in the media now is what shysters call the assumptive close." I think that's as good a précis as any, Richard. And what we don't yet grasp, I think, for example, is the determination of the Democrat Party. Election theft is a Democrat Party thing. Political machines are a Democrat Party thing. If you listen to the Mark Stein show, you'll know that a week ago I read an excerpt from The Shame of Our Cities by Lincoln Steffens, published in 1904. And he goes and looks at the worst cities for election fraud, some of which are still today, the same cities today, Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Minneapolis and New York, as well as St. Louis and various other places. And he goes through it all. And there's a little vignette that I read out where he's pointing out to a guy in Philadelphia, a white man in Philadelphia, that he is as powerless and irrelevant as a Negro in the South at the time. This was when black Americans voted overwhelmingly for the Republican Party. They supported the Republican Party, but they couldn't get to vote. And he's trying to explain to this guy, this white guy in Philadelphia, that he is as irrelevant and his vote is as meaningless as a vote of a Negro in the Democrat South. And the guy eventually gets it. They've been getting up to this stuff for a century and a half, and the only difference was that the COVID provided a pretext to, in effect, introduce a new and even more insecure form of voting. So we now have mail-in ballots with no security about them at all. They don't even have to be mailed in. They're delivered by Biden-Harris trucks at 3:45 in the morning. And I'm not going to go through all this again, because it either matters to you or it doesn't. And clearly it doesn't matter to the people cheering on Joe Biden's quote-unquote victory. But, you know, the Democrats are serious about power. They're not serious about anything else. They're serious about power. So if in the early 20th century power means doing down the black vote, then they do down the black vote. As you heard on the Mark Stein show, Election Day 1920, all these black women try to vote in Atlanta, and their votes just get thrown out. This time round, a lot of votes get thrown in Atlanta, in the same place, because the needs of power vary, but the Democrats' prioritization of power doesn't. It's astonishing to me. This party would have been put out of business in almost any country on the planet because of its criminality. But the point, and I understand that if you're not terribly political, they're the people who seem to be saying all the nice, look, isn't it exciting? They elected their first non-binary city council person. Somewhere or other. Where was that? I forget what town it was. But I'd like to join in the huzzas to that, because it's like a non-binary Muslim, of all people, has been elected somewhere or other in the United States to some city council. And God bless them, they've got all the fluffy bunny stuff like that. But they're serious about power. And so everyone who thinks we should just let this one go and not complain about it, in 2 months' time in this Senate race, you better be pretty damn sure that there's going to be an honest count of votes in Georgia, because there wasn't an honest count of votes in the presidential election. And you better be sure in 2 years' time, when it's the so-called midterms, that there will be an honest count there too. Mark DeBiase, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, Mark. My apologies if I haven't. Mark says, regarding the disappearance of Abigail Schreier's book from Target, it is time for everyone to step up and only do business with the least woke or non-woke, if you're fortunate enough to find such an establishment. You may end up spending more money, but in my mind, you cannot put a price on freedom of speech. Yeah, there's a lot of false bargains. That's my argument with Walmart, for example. You know, Walmart is the cheapest crap in the world because it's all made in China by slave labor. It seems great to go get all that everyday low prices at Walmart. There's a reason there's everyday low prices, because they're all being made in China. And so the cost of those everyday low prices is that eventually you wind up living under Chinese rules too, particularly Chinese rules on freedom of speech. Mark continues, after it was clear that professional sports was more interested in playing politics than in holding sporting competitions, I ceased to follow any professional sports. Imagine what would happen if 70-plus million Trump supporters ceased to become customers of professional sports franchises until the franchises demonstrated political neutrality. Imagine the impact if all Rush Limbaugh listeners contacted Target to inquire about the book. I urge everyone to stop and think of how they can reduce patronage of any organization with an anti-free speech agenda, and help send a message that there is a price to be paid in the form of lost business that comes from alienating half the population. I agree with you, Mark. I don't want everything in life to be political, because that's basically not a conservative proposition. You know, it's bad enough to have big government, so that government... I think I did this with John Roscombe at the IPA in Australia on our special a couple of weeks ago. And I quoted the famous observation of the great English historian A.J.P. Taylor, who said that up till August 1914 and the start of the Great War, the average Englishman never intersected with anybody from government, any representative of the state, other than his postmistress and the village constable. And that was it. And that's a healthy society, one that I would like to go back to, frankly. Once government gets so big, once you have all these bureaucratic agencies essentially immune from the votes of the people, then you wind up where you have elections become pseudo affairs. Well, you're not really voting for any conservative who believes in small government, because you elect the conservatives and they then have to fill all the huge government agencies that the left of center party set up. Again, a line from my book After America, you don't need a president for life when you've got a bureaucracy for life, which is what the left has at the moment. Now we've advanced to the next stage. It's not just that small government is barely possible, but that large government has now spread out, and the politics of it has infected almost every aspect of life. To my knowledge, I don't think I've ever been in a Target, and I have no desire to go into a Target. But if I ever did go into a Target, I'd want it to be free of politics. When I'm not a watcher, as Rush knows, because every so often we've had these rather stilted conversations. Rush, actually, I'll introduce me to a very powerful, important, great football star a couple of years back. And I looked absolutely black. Rush knew. And so he rushed to explain, because I never knew who this big footballer was, as you don't say about American football. Anyway, this big football player, I can't get into it, you know, because I played rugby for so long. But I tell you what, even if I was into it, I'd be out of it now, because I don't want to see it. I don't want to see a bunch of guys standing on there. I mean, I don't like the game. But I always quite like the pre. I like the Super Bowl. I quite like, you know, all the funny ads and the halftime show and everything. But I wouldn't go anywhere near any of that now. I mean, you're being basically, these are people who America has enabled these players to live lives you couldn't live anywhere on the planet, in any part of human history, and unless you were a minor Balkan prince or some such. They live better than royalty in most cases. And so I don't want to see them shoving down my throat how vile America is. That's what it means to kneel. That's what it means to take a knee. They're insulting you. And again, this comes back to what needs to change after this election. So the Conservatives got kicked out of all the pop culture. So they were irrelevant. No one had to take them into account. If you were programming ballet or opera in New York, if you were thinking about Broadway shows, if you were thinking about Hollywood movies, if you were thinking about signing up new pop stars, we don't need any of that. That's all just lib. That's all liberal stuff. Yeah, we got like these big sports. The sports are the most chickified, as Rush says, woke sports of all. All these people, your NASCAR, your country music, your Chick-fil-A, they've all been laughing at you. So the question is, how serious are you about... But I just like, okay, I just like to be like... I think it was Mrs. Allman from CA, who's just given up on politics entirely. The thing about it is, if you want to give it up, there's actually very few places to go and give it up. Because politics is everything now. Politics is everywhere. You can't go to Target, that's politics. You go to Starbucks and they want to have, you know, the national conversation on race or whatever they're doing. And you every aspect, the gardening column in the paper is politicized and the sports is complete. Give it up. Show you're serious. These guys hate you. And they want to force you to live in their world. Do you really want to look at a man kneeling for your national anthem? I've been done with this ever since that game they played in London, where all these complete tosspots took a knee for their own national anthem, whatever lousy football team it was that was playing over at Wembley Stadium. They took a knee for their own national anthem and then stood up for God Save the Queen. What's the point of the American Revolution if you're going to stand up for... I thought, stand up for God Save the Queen, but you take a knee for the Star-Spangled Banner. And you're still watching this crap? It should have been done then. My friend Roy Epen writes... Roy is... I've had the pleasure of doing events in Ottawa and Toronto, where Roy has been the fellow who gives the loyal toast. you don't have that in the United States, the loyal toast, but we do in Canada and elsewhere within Her Majesty's dominions. It basically signals that the dining part of the evening is over and you can now all relax. used to mean that you could light up a cigarette. Back when I was dining with Princess Margaret, that's what it meant. But there's very few places you can smoke at all now in those things. But anyway, Roy does the... If you're thinking... if anyone in the United States wants to book the best loyal toast in North America, Dr. Roy is your man. Anyway, Dr. Roy says, I'm very concerned about the continued lockdown. It's killing many people. I should say, by the way, that Dr. Roy is an actual doctor, so he knows about these things. And I think that's right. I'm amazed what a ghost town the hospitals are these days, because there's no COVID patients in them. I mean, there's one or two, but there's nobody there being treated for anything else either. I went to the dentist the other day for the first time since before the lockdown, and like this was a big successful dental practice. And the dentist had all these dental hygienists. You went in there and she'd say, well, what's up? And you'd say, I've got this slight pain on the lower left-hand side. And she'd take a look at it and she'd say, yeah, you need a root canal, but ain't no chance of that for the next 6 months. So like she had all the business she needs. I went in there now, all the dental hygienists, except two or whatever it is, have been laid off. And she's looking at my mouth as the last income opportunity in the state. She's going through everything. She's going through fillings that are like perfectly fine, but you know, just like now they got much more up to date fillings because this was put by this filling with the dentist had it was Painless Potter in Bob Hope as Painless Potter put it in 1892 or whatever it was, and she's like, oh yeah, I can do that. Let's take that out. I can do that on Tuesday. Oh, we'll take a couple more out the back too while I'm at it. Desperate. This world is killing. Lockdown land is killing everything. Lockdown land is killing everything, including people who don't suffer from the COVID. But the control, they can't give it up. I mean, I'm absolutely astonished by the idea that they're regulating the number of people you have for Thanksgiving or the number of people you have for Christmas now. It's not normal to live these solitary lives. And there's something desperately sad, actually. I'm not, you know, the mask thing, I don't even reach the medical necessity of masks or otherwise, because I think it's just, it's dehumanizing in a more basic way than that. And because we weren't serious about, again, this is like one of those things where you see the train coming down the tracks towards you. But the train is far away, and so you don't do anything about it. And the train's coming down the tracks. And there's only one track. It's not going to get off course. It's coming at you. And this is what the COVID was doing in January and February, when it would have been possible to shut down borders and actually contain the thing and extinguish the thing. But I don't, you know, at a certain point, if lockdown is the only thing you have, and lockdown just goes the same way every time, you have, oh, we need to lock down. We reopen the schools and now the COVID's come back. So let's lock down again. Lockdown only defers the COVID coming back. It doesn't. So you end the lockdown and the COVID that's just been sitting out there waiting for you to end the lockdown then comes back. And it just is. It's a stupid thing, the lockdown. It should never have happened. And I feel very sorry for Dr. Roy. I feel envious of Dr. Roy for one reason. He's in Montreal and I love Montreal, and the bloody border has now been closed for 8 months. And I would love to. I considered getting takeout from Montreal, but they seize it at the border. The bastards seize it at the border and eat it themselves. That's how bad it is. Charlene Pinkava, I think you pronounce it, or Pinkava. I got it wrong. Charlene Pinkava, I think it is, right? So any recommendations for World War I history or fiction? Personal favourite. Well, that was the great tragedy, World War I. And You know, we've actually done a couple of World War One adaptations, certainly by John Buchan, both the 39 Steps and Greenmantle. And Greenmantle is a very interesting work in that respect. My favorite, because it recognizes the Great War as the divide. You know, we've been in decline in a sense since August 1914, because the West lost all the rubbish. We're suddenly evildoers, and imperialism and all the rest of it are the worst sins of humanity. That all arises from the loss of confidence from the Great War. So I think about it from that particular point of view. My personal favorite, I would have to say, Charlene, because it's such a great novel. And I've mentioned it. I've mentioned it before. Is Radetzky March by Joseph Roth? But the interesting bit, which is basically about the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the years before the Great War. But he understands, as almost everybody does, that the empire will not survive the war as it didn't. And it's interesting. They get the news towards the end. I don't want to do any plot spoilers, but towards the end, they get the news that the Archduke has been assassinated at Sarajevo. And they happen to get it while they're having this rather debauched party on the very fringes of the empire near the Russian border. And that scene is so brilliantly done. The madness of a whole world dancing on the precipice as it hears the news that the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the throne, has been assassinated in Sarajevo. And I must say, I always love historical accounts of that particular vignette, because the particular, it's always the particular that gets to you, that the Archduke's killer then tries to escape by wading into the river and swimming to safety. And he doesn't realize the river is just like 18 inches deep at that point. So it's too shallow to swim to safety. He was a stupid man. He was a stupid man, an almost unbelievably idiotic man, who nevertheless brought to an end the great 19th century period of increasing prosperity and technological innovation that, as the years go by, seems more and more like the most glorious phase of European history. Anne Pinkava, whom I assume is a relation to Charlene, which is why these questions have been placed together. Hey, Mark, what do you think of Lawrence Fox and his Reclaim Party? He may be late to the game, but he seems to be taking the erosion of British culture and freedom seriously. One could even speculate that Reclaim caused the Brexit Party to reform. But I'd love to hear what you think about it. Yeah, I think this is the ground to fight on. Well, you know, let me say two things. First, the United States has the worst party system in the world. It's had the same two lousy parties since the Civil War, and I would love it if it had a system which was friendly to the creation of new parties. I never thought particularly that the Westminster system was that friendly to the creation of new parties. But basically, since the mid-19th century, when the Tories, the Conservatives and the Liberals had every seat in Great Britain and Ireland at that time, every single seat was either Tory or Liberal. And now you have a situation where there are, like Northern Ireland alone, I think, has 17 parties, just the ones that have some kind of representation from the local to the national level. And then you have these nationalist parties in the other, what the London types refer to as the rest of the Celtic fringe in Scotland and Wales. And you have actually quite a few parties in England itself now, and none of them are really anything I'm terribly interested in. I mean, they're a wide spectrum of nutters, Whether you're talking about the Scottish Nationalists or Plaid Cymru, the Welsh Nationalists, or Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland, or whether you're talking about Labour, Liberals and Boris Johnson's Tories. I'm just, you know, Boris is the worst, and I apologise for this because I didn't realise Boris would be so easily played. Actually, I should move on at, well, no, I'll tell you what, I'll circle back to that thought. Boris would be so easily played. But basically, Boris has a bluff conservative manner while now standing for nothing in the least bit conservative. So there is no conservative party. And I think people would like a conservative party. And whether Lawrence Fox and his Reclaim party can be that party, I don't know. But the cultural battle is where it is. I've said this before. I think the old left-right distinctions, people used to think the sweet spot was to be fiscally conservative but socially liberal. And I think the sweet spot now is actually to be culturally conservative and fiscally liberal, as in a certain sense Donald Trump has been. He hasn't really, you know, reined in social security or anything like that, because there's no takers for it. Right now, what people would like is at least the consolation of culture. They don't want their societies transformed beyond recognition, and they don't want to feel that as you see on the streets of America and to a lesser extent on the streets of Britain and Europe, that everything that happened before the modern multicultural era is something that should be ashamed of. That's what everything we do at Stein Online is about. That's what Tales for Our Time is about. That's what our Mark Stein 100 Years Ago show things and our Sunday poems and all the rest of it is. That's what that is about. It's saying this is bollocks from top to toe, this theory that everything and before the day before yesterday is something to be ashamed of. It wasn't. Our music was better. Our novels were better. Our paintings were better. Our sense of ourselves was better. And to throw all that away for these solipsistic, navel-gazing twerps of the woke Stapo is completely ridiculous. The reason I wanted to, I sort of detoured into Boris there, is because we have another question on a related theme. The Londoner. We have a lot of Londoners. Yeah, we might need to have a bit more of a specific handle than that. The Londoner writes, question from this ever greener and pleasant land. By greener, I think she means the Green Party, or he means the Green Party. What do you think of Carrie? Not the horror movie, of course. This is Carrie Symons, who is the consort of my old editor, Boris Johnson, from The Spectator. Actually, Carrie is the daughter of another old editor of mine, Matthew Symons, from The Independent. I've reached that stage in life that I used to mock from Lady Benjamin, Penny Betcheman. Penelope was the wife of the poet laureate Sir John Betjeman, and she was always astonished when you mentioned someone she'd known as the child of an old friend who was now like 37 or 42 and was being given some big-time job. And Carrie Symons is a bit like that because, as I said, she's the daughter of one of my old editors at The Independent. And, you know, the Tories made a trade. Let's put it this way. I'm staggered by this, right? Because it's a long time since I've gone to London with any regularity, so I'm kind of out of touch with it. But I do notice that all the people who go way back 30 years with Boris, you know, what, little 35 years, sometimes people who knew him at university, like Toby Young, all loathe him now. My Telegraph colleagues, Alison Pearson, she says she doesn't listen to a word he says because he talks crap all the time. And And Toby Young is done with him because of what's happened with the lockdown and all the rest of it. And so what? And all these are people who basically made a deal. You know, the old line about that the Tories used to have to disreputable figures, where you wouldn't trust them either with your wallet or your wife. That was the old joke, and it doesn't apply to Boris, because Boris, who shags anything that moves. He can't actually put a number on how many children he has sired. He doesn't know. It's unknown. If you think that voting in Pennsylvania is an imprecise process, you should try doing a count of Boris's children. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. He is living in number 10 Downing Street, which nobody has ever done before, without benefit of clergy. The last time this became an issue was when Adrian Clarkson was made Governor General of Canada. I'm not a big fan of Adrian Clarkson. She was on the CBC for ages, and she's married to this rather tedious dime store philosopher, John Ralston Saul, who mainly looms in my mind for the piece he wrote about etiquette on nude beaches at Saint-Tropez, when you accidentally see an old friend and you hug and you brush genitals. And that's the great contribution to John Ralston Saul. And they'd lived together for years. And when Adrian Clarkson was appointed Her Majesty's Viceroy in the year, whatever it was, 2000, 1999, something like that, she was instructed that it would not be possible for someone to live in Government House, Rideau Hall, without benefit of clergy as the Queen's representative. So they had to get married. They'd been living as partners in this kind of post-marriage vein for ages. Now, Boris moves his pregnant mistress into 10 Downing Street and as the Queen's Prime Minister. Nobody worried about it. The Queen's just got to suck it up, because Boris is what it needs to get Brexit through. And that's the thing. The deal was this. We put up with the fact that you're basically a sleazy guy. I've talked about some of them occasionally. You've ruined, you know, significant numbers of women by your sleazy behaviour. We're so desperate now, we're turning to you to stiffen the spine of the Conservative Party and get Brexit through and all the rest of it. And he's now turned in. So what you're left with now is just completely unconservative. You've got this guy who mocks. Mrs. Thatcher would have been horrified by this. You've got this guy who mocks any kind of traditional conservative morality, so he's no good in any of that stuff. And at the same time, he hasn't got any conservative policies. He's just getting dragged further and further to the left by basically his young lady, the mother of his child, however you want to put it. And he hasn't got anything else. He's got nothing else going for him. This isn't a Conservative Party. And Lawrence Fox, I know nothing about the Reclaim Party, but they couldn't do worse than this. Emily Greenberg writes, "Hi, Mark, new member as of last week. We are delighted to have you. We are thrilled to have you, Emily. Welcome along. I do hope you enjoy it. The best is yet to come," says Emily. That was our song of the week this week. "Any advice on how I should respond to friends who think I'm a conspiracy theorist, because I believe there was indeed election fraud committed? Thank you, Tucker, for the Dead Folks Who Voted episode, regardless of whether it affects the final result." Merci, Emily. Merci à vous aussi, Emily. The thing about conspiracies is this. The left will accept that there's a conspiracy when it's Putin supposedly plotting to put Trump in the White House. So if it's something that a Republican is the beneficiary of, it's a conspiracy. If the Democrats, on the other hand, win the election or are otherwise beneficiaries, you're a nut for suggesting that there could be a conspiracy. So the conspiracies can only go one way. And secondly, this isn't even conspiracy. This is stuff that's verified. You can actually look up whether If you happen to have a dead grandfather or whatever, born in 1897 in Michigan or Pennsylvania, you can actually go to a database and check whether they voted. So unless the databases are all fraudulent, then you can see it's not a conspiracy. We've reached the point, I think, where the different realities we live in are so incompatible that actually a sort of separate but equal kind of thing might be the best, the safest thing here. And that's regrettable, and nothing good is going to come of it. Steve M. writes, "Greetings, Buck. You had recently expressed reservations about one of President Trump's law firms and about lawyers in general. Just this morning, President Trump's principal law firm in Pennsylvania is headed for the hill." I'm losing track of that, whether it's Pennsylvania or whether it was the one in Arizona or Nevada. "Would you care to provide us an update on your views regarding the change in lawyering since 1770, when John Adams represented the British soldiers in the Boston Massacre?" Well, basically all the changes that have been made to the system you inherited, I think, have made it worse. I will say, as a general proposition, everyone knows this because it's my line. I borrow it from Lord Moulton, "The Importance of the Realm of Manners," that in most societies, it's the space between what the law commands you to do and what the law forbids you to do. That space is the space where life happens, where civilized life happens, the so-called realm of manners. And in a healthy society, that's about 85%. There's a very small number of things you have to do. There's a very small number of things you're forbidden from doing. And the big space in the middle is where you live, the 88 to 90%. American lawyering has chipped away at all that, so that we now have a situation where everything is actionable in America, including this faintly preposterous situation we're seeing right now, where you have to go to court because the election system is so crap, you have to go to court to get any kind of justice there. But in all small matters, I think it's got worse too. I think I'm still correct in this, that England and Wales have as many barristers as Hartford, Connecticut. That's the difference in scale. The whole of England and Wales have as many barristers as Hartford, Connecticut. And what does that mean? Part of that means that whenever you get into any case, it goes on a lot longer. Secondly, you are in a situation where with that many lawyers, you have infinitely more judges, and they're not very good judges, because being a judge requires a judicial temperament, which most judges don't have. Then you have, and this is the biggest single change since you're talking about, since 1770, I'll go back to that law firm. It was Jones Day. I regard them as a bunch of wankers because I'm in a case with them at the moment. And they have this guy, Carvin, who blew the Obamacare case before the Supreme Court. He's an idiot. He's a lazy idiot, like a lot of hotshot American lawyers. He gets a lot of things wrong and all the rest of it. But the point is, when you contract here with a lawyer, you contract with their whole firm. So in this case, for example, if you have one lawyer from Jones Day, you're basically contracting with the whole firm. And that means that when some members of that firm who don't like this or that client go on the record or off the record to the New York Times and leak all this stuff, that's one of the consequences of having to contract with the entire law firm. As you know, if you watch any old crappy old British legal drama with blokes in wigs, that's not how it works in the rest of the common law world, where generally you're just contracting. You have your barrister, and oftentimes the guy on the other side can be represented by a barrister in the same chambers, because it's a personal relationship, as it should be. I mean, I'm tired. I could do, you know, I'm tired of this. The case in Nevada when that buffoon Katz was suing me, and I flew to Las Vegas and was talking to one of my lawyers down there who was saying, oh, I'm going to be fourth chair on this. And I'm going, what do you mean fourth chair? What is this, the string section of the Berlin Philharmonic? How many chairs are there? In Canada, there's one chair and your lawyer sits in it, like my friend Julian Porter, who handled all three of the Canadian human rights suits. And the biggest thing, again, I could do, we're going to actually think about how we cover legal matters here. It may be one of our big changes to come in the event that the Kamala administration actually takes power. But the biggest change, of course, is that you don't have loser pays. And if you don't have loser pays, you have more litigation than any society needs. And people say, well, we do this so that everybody has equal access to the courts. So that's actually what doesn't happen here. The minute you don't have loser pays, what it means is the guy with the deepest pocket wins because he can keep it going the longest. And so you actually exclude people from the courts for that reason. And that's what that bastard Katz and his crappy third-rate, whatever the name of that lousy network was, that's what he thought he had with me because he's a so-called billionaire. I don't think he is actually a billionaire anymore. He was sort of pleading that in the last case in the witness box. But that's what he thought he could do with me. And that's what the stupid, the whole system is set up. We went into mediation, and the mediator, who was this ridiculous New York tosser, he assumed that I was the one who had to cave because I was broker. So the guy with more money, he wins the case because he could keep it going for long, unless you go into mediation where the guy with more money prevails because the mediator understands that the quickest way to get a result is to get the guy with less. And I said, that doesn't work. I don't care about the money. I'm Canadian. I can keep this going as long as... all the perversions over the last two centuries have been a disaster. Robert writes, thanks so much for the Jim Radford song. The melody he used, though, seems to be an old Irish one, Frana an Lie, The Dawning of the Day, which also appears on Raglan Road, which his song may even predate. Maybe for one of your detailed song histories, the ages of people like Jim Radford recall someone else on a battlefield at the same age, but on the other side, as it were, Omar Khadr. In the light of all the Jim Radfords, why does Khadr get a pass as a child soldier? He was the guy who killed an American on the battlefields of Afghanistan and was at Gitmo. He was a Canadian, so-called. He wasn't a Canadian, of course. He was hot for jihad. But by Canadian, we mean a person who holds Canadian citizenship. So when you get shot fighting for the jihad, it's great because you can be you can fly back to Toronto and get treated at no expense in an Ontario hospital. You're right. The interesting thing, all the people, Peter Worthington, to take another Canadian, he lied about his age to get into the Royal Canadian Navy. Peter Worthington was the editor of the Toronto Sun, a great Canadian newspaper man. But he and I used to talk about how he lied about his age to get into the Royal Canadian Navy at the start of the war. That's where, if you were a teenage boy, if you were like 14 or 15, you pretended to be 17 or 18 so you could get onto a ship and you could go to where the war was. And this idea now that, I mean, this is actually the problem, that Jim Radford was a 15-year-old man, and now we have 35-year-old boys. And the way we have this protracted adolescent, oh, he's just a child, he's just, Hunter Biden, he's just a child, he's like 53, but he's, have you no shame, have you no decency to go after Joe Biden's child? He's just a child. He's like those little girls that Joe Biden likes to sniff their hair off. You know, we have totally revised our expectation of men. And as a result, we have very few of them. On the tune, yeah. As I said, I didn't think it was a great tune, and whether consciously or not, he just wrote his words to some tune that was floating around in the back of his head. But you know, that's how a lot of songs we still sing get to be, including the Star Spangled Banner, just to name one instance, that are sung to the tunes of old English drinking songs or old Irish drinking songs, whose copyright remains uncertain. But that's I'm touched by the way so many people were moved by that Jim Radford song. Gregory Lawton. That's a very distinguished name. That's Laughton, like Charles Lawton. But having Gregory instead of Charles makes it sound even more distinguished, I think. Gregory Lawton says, "My assessment is that if Donald Trump had Ronald Reagan's pleasant and reassuring presentation and manner, he would have won the election overwhelmingly. Of those that I could have a civil conversation about politics the past years, all who opposed Trump cited intense dislike of him personally, with little assessment of his actual policy. What do you think?" Well, I've always had a view of this. Going back, there's a piece I wrote, I think, a month or so, back when he insulted John McCain. And the piece is called "The Super Bowl of Super Holes," because John McCain was the. I've seen John McCain insult New Hampshire voters in the 2000 primary, actually insult them to their face and tell them the mills never kind of basically say whatever the version of learn to code was back then. He was so rude to people. To people who had no money, no life, no hope, and this big wealthy guy comes in and puts down the little man, punches down, and the papers all write him up as a maverick. So I always thought that basically, always had a low opinion of John McCain from that point of view, and Trump was very much his match in that when he got into it with John McCain at that time. And if you read that piece, "The Super Bowl of Super Holes," everyone knows that this is who Donald Trump is. And the thing about it is that you can't have one without the other. I supported Trumpism. No country, no nation needs mass immigration in the year 2020. No developed nation needs mass immigration. So I want a guy who wants to just put that in the public conversation. Secondly, I'm not in favor of China taking over the world. So I want someone who's going to put that into the conversation. Third, I'm not in favour of most of these big trade deals like NAFTA. I want someone who's going to put that into the conversation. Fourth, I think the epidemic of drugs in New Hampshire and other places from which the mills and the factories and the farming are all fled. I'd like someone who wants. And Donald Trump was talking about all of this stuff, and he was the only one going. Talking about it, and they didn't want him to talk about it, so they start going on about a lot of piffling trivia, and you had to be Trump-sized to smash through that and get Trumpism. Trump had to be Trump-sized to get Trumpism into the national conversation, and there's a difference between that, and I don't want to start the bloodletting early, because we're in a far worse situation than we were at the time Reagan was elected, when Jimmy Carter was just a four-year blip in America's glorious post-1950 moment. It's worse now. It's worse now. We've got downward mobility. We've got dead towns, dead communities. We've got transformative demography. We've got all kinds of stuff. And I felt, I want to hold off on the bloodletting, but I felt there wasn't enough Trumpism in Trump's campaign. And if this does go all south, I think it starts even earlier than that disastrous debate. And I think it goes back to that thing in Tulsa where he talked about his shoes and walking down the ramp for 15 minutes. And that was his first rally after the lockdown and everything. He wasn't talking like he was when I went to Trump events 4 years ago. And the stuff he said was great, and it appealed to the base. But it didn't appeal beyond the base. We can have this, as I said, we'll wait and we'll start the bloodletting a little later. But, you know, Trump and Trumpism needed each other. Trumpism, the policies he advanced are policies that the Uni Party doesn't want to talk about. And if Mike Pence attempted to talk about those policies, he'd be crushed like a bug. And so it was necessary to have a Trump figure who could railroad them through. He won the election on Tuesday night. Things are fast moving now, and we will see where these legal appeals go. We've overrun a few minutes. I'm terribly sorry about that, but this was our first one. I'll do a big picture question. David Kellywood says, Mark, it seems like the phrase the free world is on the verge of going the way of Camelot, in that once there was such a thing. At least that's the way it feels should Trump's legal challenges fail to gain him a second term. Am I being too pessimistic? By the way, we'll be listening today for the first time from Minnesota, as opposed to from China. David Kellywood was over in Wuhan. Thought I'd do a comparison of totalitarian states, says David. Yeah, Wuhan looks like a real party town when you see it now by comparison with locked down parts of the Western world. I don't think you can say the free world when you look at the way most people now get their information from the cartel of woke billionaires ever since Tuesday, election night, that totalitarian weird beard Jack Dorsey and the other guy Zuckerberg have been putting the thumb on the scale. It's happening very fast. You can't call it a free world where you're not allowed to disagree with the official version of events. Not when the official version of events is determined by Zuckerberg and Dorsey. This is the biggest issue. This is, as I've been saying here for months, it's all going to go south very quickly. You look at who are the guys in the transition team of Joe Biden, assuming he's transitioning into becoming president. He's got a transition team. There is actually someone who was touted as the first transgender American to be put on a presidential transition team. I think that's Joe just getting confused about what transition he thought people were getting mixed up in. But he's appointed a transgender to the transition team. God bless him. Everybody else are just these big tech guys, these lobbyists, big tech lobbyists. The swamp is back. The swamp is back big time. And we're all going to, and if you value liberty, if you value a decent respect for a multiplicity of views, you're screwed. Because the last photocopier in the woods scenario is accelerating towards us. Because as usual, useless American senators, including Republicans like Mike Lee, who was it? Was it Google? Amazon? One of them moved into his state in Utah. He suddenly fell quiet about a whole lot of things he shouldn't have been quiet about. So the Republicans have done nothing about big tech. And now nothing's going to be done until they've cemented their grip on the whole of the planet's information. I will try to have a cheerier thought or two for you with Tucker tonight in 3 hours' time, 8 p.m. U.S. Eastern. That might be just an hour's time if you're listening to the action replay of that, or you might have missed it entirely. But I'll be on with Tucker, 8 p.m. U.S. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and we will have, As a diversion from all this kind of stuff, we will have movies and music for you over the weekend. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you next time.